WFHR, Wisconsin Rapids, 1320 AM and W248DE, broadcasting at 97.5 FM.
From Wisconsin Rapids to Stevens Point, your news, talk, and sports is on 97.5 FM, locally grown radio.
This is CBS News on the Hour, your home for original reporting.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. President Biden talks publicly about China's spy balloon and three others shot down recently. CBS's Stephen Portnoy.
The president said it's the current assessment of the intelligence community that the three objects he ordered shot out of the sky within the last week did not belong to China.
These three objects were most likely balloons tied to private companies, recreation or research institutions studying weather, or conducting other scientific research.
As for the larger Chinese spy balloon, Mr. Biden says he'll be talking that over with Xi Jinping.
And I hope we're going to get to the bottom of this, but I make no apologies for taking down that balloon.
Stephen Portnoy, CBS News, the White House.
Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman is in the hospital after seeking help for severe depression. CBS's Scott McFarland.
A statement from his chief of staff says John Fetterman checked himself into the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center for treatment for depression. The statement says Fetterman has experienced depression, quote, on and off throughout his life, but that it became severe in recent weeks. Fetterman is also recovering from a stroke suffered during a very heated campaign for Pennsylvania's Senate seat last year.
Winter storm warnings are in effect tonight across the Midwest, including Wisconsin, Illinois, and Iowa. For this south-central Iowa driver,
it's ice covered, snow covered, semis white out, obviously, when you can't see.
The investigation into corruption charges against the Republican Attorney General of Texas is handed to the Justice Department in Washington, D.C. from federal prosecutors in Texas. Reporter Chris Fox.
In 2020, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton's top deputies went to the FBI with bribery and abuse of office charges against him. He's denied wrongdoing. Now his attorneys say they actually petitioned for the DOJ in Washington to take over the investigation. Rice University political scientist Mark Jones says Paxton's legal team is dragging out the investigation on purpose.
This is going to add an additional delay, perhaps until there's a new administration, one that could be a Republican administration that may investigate this case less strenuously.
Chris Fox for CBS News, Austin.
Baseball's Hall of Fame says that All-Star catcher Tim McCarver, who won two World Series titles with the St. Louis Cardinals, has died of heart failure. McCarver spent 18 years calling baseball games on Fox. He said when it came time to retire in 2013,
fairness and accuracy and honesty have always been my goals, along with teaching you something you may not have known about this great game. I hope I've achieved those things.
A Central Regional High School student in New Jersey is dead. Four classmates face criminal charges for allegedly bullying her, and the district superintendent has resigned. At tonight's school board meeting, this mother says her repeated complaints about the district's teachers have gone unanswered.
Are we supposed to expect the students to learn not to bully and to be better when they're learning it from their educators?
This is CBS News.
Paid for by government.com.
Did you hear? A recent stash of $10 gold Liberty coins from the 1800s has been found. These gorgeous gold coins are as bright and shiny as the day they were struck in the late 1800s, and less than 50 of these gold coins are available. Coin experts are calling this gold find an incredible opportunity.
Call 1-800-935-7267,
and you are guaranteed a $10 gold Liberty coin minted by the U.S. Mint in the 1800s. But with extremely limited availability, you must call now. Now, these gold Liberty coins from the 1800s are still in uncirculated condition. That is history you can hold in your hand.
To learn more, call 1-800-935-7267.
Call now and you'll receive a free American Coin Collector's Bonus Package, a $40 value, free with every order.
Call 1-800-935-7267 now to secure your $10 gold Liberty coins dated from the 1800s before they sell out. That's 1-800-935-7267.
What's the secret?
I'm Sawyer.
And I'm Shannon.
Together, we're Twin Stunts, the only twin motorcycle freestyle show in the world. We are born and raised in Wisconsin, so we want all our fellow cheeseheads to know that even though we clutch it up, hit 12, and drift in our show, we would never do it on the open road. And there's another thing we would never do on the road. Drive drunk. Drive sober, or get pulled over. Together, we can save lives. Learn more at ZeroInWisconsin.gov. Wisconsin DOT.
Let's face it, life looks a little different. During these times, we're doing our best to keep our minds and bodies strong. And getting a flu shot helps us stay healthy, so we don't miss out on what matters. Like having game night at home. Yeah, can't do that while sick with the flu. Now imagine family movie night that your daughter can't live without. Well, that's ruined. And don't forget your uncle's socially distanced cookout. See? That's why it's important to be at our strongest. Every year, millions of people in the U.S. get the flu. Especially now, no one has time to miss out on moments that matter. So get your flu shot. Find out more at getmyflushot.org. Brought to you by the AMA, CDC, and the Ad Council.
Here's your forecast from locally grown radio WFHR. Mainly cloudy skies expected tonight with a chance of flurries. Lows dip down to about 8 above. North winds 8 to 15 miles per hour. Mainly sunny skies tomorrow. Highs around 27. Lows dip down to about 20. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy skies. High of 40 Saturday under cloudy skies. 41 Sunday. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki. Currently, it's 22.
Keep up on the day's news, talk, and sports on Wisconsin's home for locally grown radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR, 1320 AM.
The Rage Against the War group is going to hold their rally against the military-industrial complex. A lot of right-wing loony money, a lot of libertarian money going to be there. And look, Jill Stein will be there, so I'm sure there'll be some Russian money as well. We can't fund anything going to Ukraine. And my question to them is always, okay, I'm anti-war as well. I don't think we should be blowing things up and killing people. What's your solution? And look, I love Roger Waters. I love Pink Floyd. But this idea of just, you know, diplomacy, yeah, diplomacy, great. It still isn't going to stop Russia from dropping bombs on these people's heads. Sometimes you got to ball up your digits and fight a little bit. I think Biden has done the absolute right thing, but we'll see the rage against the war machine. We're going to see them having their hissy fit on the 19th. So that'll be interesting to pay attention to. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, my good friend Sarah Burris. She's a reporter over at Raw Story, rawstory.com. Actually lives in the D.C. area. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Hello, how are you?
So you go into the big Rage Against the War Machine rally there on the 19th?
No, I'm going to the beach.
Probably a better use of your time.
I kind of feel like it is too. We are going to the beach for a vacay, which I'm very excited about. But it's funny though that so many Republicans and libertarians are supportive of this anti-war movement when I feel like that's what we've been talking about since we got into Iraq and Afghanistan. And you know, we kind of were just sitting back like, you know, this is a bad idea. At some point you're going to realize this is a bad idea.
Yep.
Several years later. What's interesting is, so one of the stories that came out this week is that a bunch of, I think it was like 40 memos that George W. Bush and his national security people wrote for Barack Obama as he was coming in. 30 of the 40 have been released and are now declassified. And so they're going to be put out in some sort of, you know, book or something. But one of the main things that he warns of is, you know, infamously Bush said, I looked into Putin's eyes and saw his soul.
Sure.
And one of the memos basically goes, our relationship is soured. Putin is intent on taking Ukraine. He's specifically looking at Crimea. I mean, it was like, every single thing that happened was in this memo. And so it's this idea that we have had two different parties, four different approaches to Russia, and none of them have worked. So, I mean, really, other than paying Ukraine to fight them over there so we don't have to fight them here, like, what do you do?
Exactly. And this is where my point is. Okay, I'm with you. I'm not in favor of war, but what's your solution? Sorry, diplomacy hasn't worked. Russia has continued to do what they were going to do whenever they wanted to do it. It has nothing to do with anything that we're doing. China, same thing. They're going to do whatever the hell they want to do, no matter what we say to them. At some point, there's got to be a stick. And this is the best option. We're not sending our soldiers over there to the fight. We're just giving people the ability to defend themselves. And I don't see anything wrong with that.
Yeah, I much prefer the idea of us not sending people boots on the ground. Any opportunity we can to avoid boots on the ground, even if it means, you know, having an army of drones that we're piloting from like Xbox 360s all over the U.S. Like, totally cool with that, just as long as we can keep our people here and keep them alive.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting moment. And look, you know, the thing is that we should, again, you know, it shouldn't be partisan when you're talking about national intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
This shouldn't be a right team, red team, blue team thing, mm-hmm. right, left. This should be, you know, like, as you said, you know, Bush was telling Obama. Obama probably told Trump, you know, Mitt Romney going, look, Russia's a threat. And everyone on the left mocked him for it. Mm-hmm. And the right. I mean, he was mocked all around. The right going, no, he's our friend. They give us all kinds of money. And then the left was going, oh, you're crazy. Yeah, he's right.
Yeah. So, and how many years later we're now facing
11.
What we've just put off for years and years and years.
And it comes down to misinformation. It comes down to the F channel and all of the right wing mm-hmm. blather, which is why I was happy to see that they lost in court to shut down that Smartmatic lawsuit. I'm hoping they lose their shorts. I'm hoping they lose everything. This is a multi-billion-dollar suit. I hope it shuts them down.
Oh, and the best thing that has happened today is the court filing between Dominion and Fox has been published online. And so there's like 200 pages with 200 pages of footnotes in addition to that. 400 pages of glorious, amazing emails of Fox News people agreeing that the 2020 election conspiracy, you know, fraud thing from Trump was complete BS. They knew it was BS, and they were embracing it. And it is listening to, like, they're making fun of each other. Like, you've got Tucker Carlson fighting with Laura Ingraham, and then there's a fact checker that Tucker gets mad at, and he's like, our stock is going down, and you're just like, oh my god, this is a real conversation that they have.
Yep.
And they've got it via text, via email. It is just 400 pages of insanity.
No, I mean, they've actually documented their own treason. Because, mm-hmm. you know, I go back to what the question I asked earlier in the last hour, you know, which is worse, a true believer who truly believes their BS?
Yeah.
Or someone who knows better but still spews the BS because it's profitable, it meets their aims, their ideology. And these emails from the few that I've been able to see puts all those Fox people in that. They knew better. They knew what they were doing. They knew they were using the dupes and the morons that you know, religiously watched them to peddle their nonsense so that they could sell their products and line their pockets.
So there's two different ways to look at it. You've got the people who are the true believers. So you got to figure out, like, okay, well, what do you have to do to convince them otherwise? And being able to change somebody's mind if they have, like, these strongly held beliefs. There was actually a New York Times story on this. That people have this psychological part of their brain that makes them less likely to want to admit that they're wrong, even when they know that they are, and that they'll double down just based on that ego and that arrogance. And the part of, like, the Fox News people who were knew that they were doing wrong and were making stuff up, I think lawsuits like this help deter that, because then you can come back to them and be like, yes, this is morally wrong, but guess what? You're going to lose $3 billion. And there's a lot of people who are going to lose their jobs, and you may not have a show anymore. So, like, sort of forcing them to reckon with these lawsuits and have consequences, I think you have an actual chance of making change at that point.
Yeah. Now, I had someone ask me, well, they're Fox News. They're protected by the Constitution. They're news. They're the press. Maybe they got it wrong once or twice or a million times, but they're still the press, so they're protected. Is that a legitimate argument?
No. That is the funny part, is that this idea that folks think that the First Amendment is absolute, it's not. It's exactly, it's yelling fire in a crowded theater, right? That is your First Amendment right to free speech. Actually, that's a danger to society. So when something like this endangers people, you face off against, you know, these things like liability and defamation. And so if you knowingly lie, then there are very real civil consequences to that. And it might mean you're not going to prison, but you're going to have to fork over some serious cash.
Now, does that, it would just be their insurance companies that would get hit with this. Or I'm sure there's got to be a rider in there that if you knowingly violate the terms of this agreement, the insurance doesn't cover. Are we seeing any of that, or is that down the road?
You know, I don't even know about that, because you're talking about two different companies that are looking at the billions. I don't know if that might just bankrupt their insurance company. And Fox is really the only one that can afford this. And I don't know to what extent you have some kind of insurance protection over screw ups like this.
No, not screw ups. You know, like, I don't see this as a screw up. This was deliberate. They did this on purpose. You know, it's the Les Muñoz thing, saying, you know, Trump's probably bad for democracy, but he's good for ratings. So that's all they cared about. They cared about the ratings. They didn't care about being, you know, true to their viewers or being honest or laughably fair and balanced. They didn't care about any of that. They cared about the cash.
And I would love to see sort of the cost benefit analysis of that. Like, how much money did they make over the last couple of years? And was it more than what they're going to have to pay Dominion and Smartmatic?
Yeah,
At what point does it not become, financially expedient?
And then they get to play the victim card. Look at how they, you know, I mean, because now my mind is going, now you've got me thinking in this, because Republicans and conservatives are, nobody plays the victim card like they do. Nobody does the, oh, woe is me. Look what they're doing to me. Nobody does that better than they do.
Nobody.
So my mind is, how they spin this to where they're now the victim because of their own actions. Kind of like the Twitter thing that we're seeing on the in Congress. You know, all these people, look what they did to me. No, you violated the terms. You knew what you were doing. You did this on purpose. And now they're going, oh, well, look, poor me. Oh, poor me.
That's why I think the 400 pages that I referenced are really important. The more we can show excerpts of this, the more we can basically show them these hosts. They're not even news people. We can show these hosts as being a fraud. And the more we get that message out, I think the better.
And Schmucker Carlson, he's actually said they're not news, right? Wasn't that his defense?
Yeah. It was a defense that he had in, what was it? It's been a while, but his defense was, we are not news. We are
entertainment
personalities. Yeah. And so basically Fox's argument has been that everything in primetime on every evening, those are personalities and they're hosts. They're not reporters. They're not journalists. They're not newsmen.
Yeah. Let's see how that works out. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Sarah Burris. Sarah's a reporter over at Raw Story, rawstory.com, the website. I want to talk about her most recent story on evidently Trump lost for the sixth time in Georgia. How do you lose six times in one election?
Right. I mean, that's the sad thing is every single time we're dealing with these grand juries, and there's going to be, this has been a special grand jury, which has totally different rules. So you can't indict from a special grand jury. The all of the findings have been handed over to a new grand jury that will start next month. They have the power to do indictments. Apparently, there have been recommendations for indictments. And so the special grand jury decided today that no, there was no fraud in the 2020 election. No, Donald Trump did not win the 2020 election. So, that's another time, another lawsuit he basically lost, and another court saying that he was wrong. And then we get to go to the next grand jury in March when they can say the same thing again. And then it'll be the seventh time.
Are you tired of winning yet?
So much winning.
So much winning with the best words. It's remarkable when you stop and think about it. Another question I think on everybody's mind, we now find out that, you know, people are regretting the whole deep state argument. They're regretting getting on all this because they're now finally, you know, the wheels of justice grind slowly. Now finally it's being exposed and they're going to be held accountable. No,
that's actually true. There's Lev Parnas, if you remember from Lev and Igor, the two associates of Rudy Giuliani. Lev Parnas is out of prison and he's now in home confinement. And he spoke to MSNBC yesterday and gave the most fascinating interview I have ever seen. It reminded me a lot kind of the sort of psychological after effects of Michael Cohen, where, you know, basically coming to this realization of, holy crap, I was in a cult. And that's exactly how Lev Parnas described it, as he was like, I really, truly believed. I mean, I grew up in Brooklyn. This is Rudy Giuliani and Donald Trump. These were people that I trusted. And they told me that there was this deep state conspiracy and that, you know, I had to do my patriotic duty to protect America. And I thought that I was really legitimately doing that. And slowly I started to, you know, see Giuliani, like, you know, beating down these Ukrainian politicians and all of the stuff that was going on. Like, and it sort of, I had that realization of, oh crap, what have I gotten into? And then he was arrested and then he was thrown in jail.
Thanks, Rudy. Now, if we only, right? Now, if only Rudy would be held accountable. I mean, you know, the people, this is my problem with all of this. And I said this on January 7th. You know, the reality is the dupes and the idiots who are doing the destructive stuff, who are defecating on the floor and urinating on desks and doing, you know, that good God-fearing stuff. Yeah, we're going to hold them accountable. They're going to get slapped on the wrist. But the people who are behind all this, the people who are the money, the people who funded it, the people who organized it, they're going to get off scot-free because that's how it always works. The wealthy and the powerful always seem to get away. And look, I look at this thing with Matt Gaetz.
Talk about the biggest piece of BS this week. Oh, my God. I think Rudy Giuliani in Fulton County, I think he was probably one of the ones who lied to the grand jury. I would not be surprised if he ends up being indicted for that. Like, the thing is, you know, you can kind of, you know, weasel your way into lying in court, but you lie to a grand jury, they're coming for you.
Yep.
I mean, that's serious business. And so they said at least one indictment out of that. You know, so when, in the case of people like Matt Gaetz, I don't get what the hell happened here, because they handed them the evidence on a platter. And I mean, the only thing folks are basically saying, you know, the girls that would be witnesses in this case and the tax dude that would be the witness in this case are unreliable people that you couldn't put, you know, on the stand to testify against a congressman. And I just feel like,
even a skeezy congressman.
I get that. I totally get that. I don't think that means that you should ignore justice. Like, there should be at least some kind of trial here, because it just means that more members of Congress are going to think that they can get away with anything.
Yeah, but now you got gun fetish Barbie going out there saying he was exonerated.
Yeah, and it's so frustrating.
My response was that GED education didn't help you find out what the word exonerated means.
Oh, bless her heart. She's had a rough week, too. She went after Rachel Maddow for not being smart enough. And everybody's like, oh, honey, it took you four times to pass the GED. And she's got a Stanford BA and a doctorate from Oxford. Like, don't go there.
Yeah. That,
don't try.
that GED is not serving you well. Finally, I want to get your thoughts on the story that came out yesterday of the Tiki Torch guy in Charlottesville who decided, and look, I said yesterday, and I got a couple of angry emails, he did us all a favor. I wasn't advocating for suicide, but did us all a favor. I questioned how it is that he got out of jail. How do you get out of jail when you are caught with 33 pounds of fentanyl? Look, you know, there's a guy, you know, the story outside of Philadelphia, a guy stole three peppermint patties, spent 500 and some days in waiting for a trial in jail because he couldn't afford to buy. How does somebody with 33 pounds of fentanyl, how does he get out?
I mean, the only thing I can think is white guy in Arizona, because that's where it came over the border. And I mean, maybe Arizona really is just that bad at this point, that white guy in Arizona gets to go out and deal with his, you know, his normal life in another, in his other state with his wife and family. It's Missouri. He's from Missouri.
Right.
But yeah, it was just a ridiculous, and it wasn't just fentanyl. I think it was like meth, fentanyl, weed, and some other stuff.
Oh, it was a whole bunch of stuff. But yet all we hear from Republicans is the border's open because those immigrants are coming in, and the Chinese are coming in at every place, not just the border crossings. You know, they're doing all this stuff. I mean, the fear and the smear that's out there is, wow, breathtaking.
And it's sad, too, because it's taking the fentanyl issue in particular really hacks me off, because it's taking the focus off of the opioid epidemic. It's basically moving the opioid problem and pharma, big pharma, over to a border issue. And they're letting pharma off scot-free for their involvement in basically pushing, you know, crazy drugs on kids for sprains and strains. And this idea of people are you know, we got to stop fentanyl from coming over because it's killing people. It's like, well, people aren't doing fentanyl. People don't like snort fentanyl. It's the opioids that they're doing, and there's just fentanyl cut into it.
Right.
So, you know, it's, and people were dying of heroin overdoses before there was fentanyl. So We're basically shifting the blame to something else, and we're not dealing with the actual problem. And instead, Republicans keep saying, you know, complaining like, oh, my God, this is so terrible. They seized more fentanyl on the border. And it's like, do you not want them to seize it? I don't understand. Like, why is this a bad thing? And then they complain about, well, you know, you got to think about how much they're not seizing. Do you hate ICE? Like, is that what you're saying? Like, there's really... You're not going to win here.
Yeah. No, but I found it very interesting that, you know, here's this guy, you know, white guy, you know, because we're told the image that we're given, you know, it's those, you know, name your minority group. It's them bringing it across, you know, on mules or however they think they're getting it in.
It's
here.
Always from American citizens. I mean, it is the stats of immigrant versus Americans is ridiculous. It's all Americans that are bringing it over.
Yeah, they're the ones who can get through the border crossings. That makes a lot of, because this stuff isn't coming in large numbers. Now, there are some places where it does come through underground tunnels and stuff, but that stuff, they ferret that out. Most of it's coming through legal ports of entry, like, you know, a white guy, you know, bringing 33 pounds. My mind just blew when I'm 33 pounds. How arrogant do you have to be to go, yeah, I can get this. I get this 33 pounds of drugs through the drug sniffing dogs and all that. And then
his excuse to the cops was, well, some guy asked me to, you know, if I would do this. And I was like, okay, like that was his excuse is, you know, well, I didn't, he just asked me if I drive this car over and I didn't ask any questions. So yeah, I didn't know what was in there. Like, oh, sure. Right.
That's a great defense.
But instead, we're like beating down the mom carrying the baby in a diaper versus the guy driving 30 pounds of fentanyl in a Subaru, you know?
33 pounds. I mean, I keep coming back to this. I mean, and this is a guy who was viewed by the Trump world as, you know, he's out there fighting the good fight with his tiki torch and his clown outfit, you know, good white Christian male. Yeah, yeah.
Saturdays at 1, don't miss Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, featuring legendary Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram. Football, life, and fun.
Earl, you've been driving a Yugo. They just gave you a brand new Ferrari with turbo boost. So enjoy it, brother.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram. Saturdays at 1 on the Civic Media Network and on the Civic Media app.
Hey, Dad, your prescription will be ready in just a minute.
Hey, Dad, your laundry will be ready in just a minute. Dad, your lunch will be ready in just a minute.
Hey, honey, why don't you take a minute?
When you help care for a loved one, you give them as much time as you can, making sure they're safe and comfortable. But it's just as important that you take some time for yourself. At AARP, we can help with information and useful tips on how you can maintain a healthy life balance, care for your own physical and mental well-being, and manage the challenges of caring for a loved one. Because the better care you take of yourself, the better care you can provide for your loved one.
Thanks, Dad.
Thank you. You're there for them. We're here for you. Find free care guides to support you and your loved one at aarp.org/caregiving. That's aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
If you've been listening, you know you can get your free credit report at annualcreditreport.com. But how do you use it? Paying attention to key pieces of information on the report, including your personal information, open credit accounts, and credit inquiries, can help you not only understand your credit standing and catch any errors, but regularly checking your credit report may also help you identify potential fraud or identity theft. Everyone is entitled to a free credit report from each of the three main credit bureaus once every 12 months. Yet only 1 in 3 Wisconsin adults actually obtain the report each year. An easy way to remember to check your report is to simply mark your calendar. Picking dates like February 2nd or 2-2 make it even easier to remember. Go to annualcreditreport.com to get started with your free credit report, and don't forget to keep listening for more tips. This message has been brought to you by the United Way of Southwood and Adams County's Financial Stability Coalition.
Parents make a lot of promises to their kids. We promise to be there every step of the way, especially on those wobbly first steps. We promise to always keep them safe. I mean, nothing's more important to us than that. And now, all kids 6 months and older can get a COVID vaccine. So we've got another way to keep that promise.
We can do this. Find vaccines near you at vaccines.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Chris Domine is a husband and a father. Chris is an athlete. Chris is even an Ironman. But 10 years ago, Chris was facing a very different story because his kidneys were failing.
Basically, the doctor said, if you don't get a kidney transplant and if you don't do dialysis, you are going to die.
Fortunately, Chris received a second chance at life, made possible by an organ donor.
You know, your well-being changes from loss of hope to better times ahead.
More than 100 million people in America are registered organ, eye, and tissue donors. People of every age and ethnicity, because they believe it's the right thing to do. Imagine what you can make possible by leaving behind the gift of life. Learn more and sign up as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. Go to organdonor.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.
Here's your forecast from locally grown radio WFHR.
Mainly cloudy skies expected tonight with a chance of flurries. Lows dip down to about 8 above. North winds 8 to 15 miles per hour. Mainly sunny skies tomorrow. Highs around 27. Lows dip down to about 20. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy skies. High of 40 Saturday under cloudy skies. 41 Sunday.
For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki.
Currently, it's 22.
From the home of NASCAR's Dick Trickle, locally grown radio, 97.5 FM and WFHR 1320 AM, your news, talk, and sports station.
Lighten and bring our community together. The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 11 on Civic Media and on the Civic Media app.
My Alzheimer's diagnosis was hard to take,
but early detection allowed us to take control of the situation. Together.
Talk to your family about seeing a doctor. Go to alz.org/time to talk. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
To help push for better, contact theconsumervoice.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, with all the talk of balloons and trains and all of the idiocy that we're seeing coming out of Congress, because guess what? Congress is going to, the Republican House is going to take their clown show on the road. Evidently, according to their secret memo that was somehow released, I'm sure they wanted it. They're going to do 15, I guess, road shows somewhere around the country, just, you know, to bring their idiocy and their craziness to, well, to an F channel near you. So big fun. The one thing we're not talking about is actually getting things done for the American people, solving problems, creating lots of them, solving them, a whole different story. And the sad thing is we've already forgotten about Tyree Nichols and the brutal murder of this guy who was just trying to go home. And again, this happens time and time again. There's a bit of outrage, and then it just goes away with no policy to move us in the right direction. And here to help maybe get us back on track and talking about this, I've asked Rachel Eisenberg to come talk with us. She's the Senior Director of Criminal Justice Reform at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, their website. They've got a new piece out now on, will this time be the time that serves as a catalyst to root out the racial injustice in policing? Rachel, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I guess that's my first question. You know, when, what time is going to be that time? I mean, we said about George Floyd. We've said it, go back, Trayvon Martin. We've gone back through all of these and said, now is the time. We've got to stop this insanity. And sadly, we don't.
I mean, you're right to express your frustration. It's something that really can't wait, and yet for some reason continues to wait. And every time we're confronted with the loss of another innocent life, we really have to question what is it going to take for us to move in the direction of real change. And what I'll say is every time the national spotlight is on policing is another opportunity. And so it is important to both honor the people whose lives are lost by continuing to fight for change, continuing to try and change policy and change culture in policing so that more people don't lose their lives.
No, I go through this all the time where you go, there are things we can and we should be doing that we're just not. And I've had friends of mine say, well, it's a racial issue. And I agree, it's a racial issue. There's a big part of that. But it's also, for me, it's a poverty issue. Look, as a kid growing up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, the minority and a minority community, I watched police be abusive back then. Maybe not to the degree we're seeing now from my experience, but you saw this kind of abuse, this kind of power trip, if you will, that they have over poor people, white and black. And this should be, in my view, one of those moments where everybody comes together and goes, no, this isn't the kind of policing we want. I just fear that the racial component, stops us from getting involved in that. Or do you see it differently?
I mean, everybody should, should be outraged by what happened to Tyree Nichols, what happened to George Floyd, what has happened to countless others whose names were both in the headlines and those whose names were not in the headlines. And frankly, there is an issue within the culture of policing that creates this us versus them mentality, right? That, there's an insular kind of protective culture between police that really pits them against the community. And yes, of course, the harms done by those practices are felt most acutely and particularly in Black communities. There's, no shortage of evidence of that. So we have to recognize that, we have to name that, we have to look for policies that change that. But we also have to recognize that there are things that are universal about the culture of policing that are part of that equation.
Right. Now, you write in your piece that Black drivers account for 26% of deaths at the hands of policemen. 26%. That means, if my math is right, 74% of people who aren't Black get killed aren't Black. Now, you make the right point that the blacks only make up 13% of the population. So being 26% of those being killed is, you know, well, obviously, you know, double their societal weight. But, you know, for me, this is, you go, hey, look, you know, yeah, they're killing a lot of black people, but they're killing a lot of people. And I understand that, you know, what we see is this brutality, like in Memphis, or in, you know, in Milwaukee, you know, I think there should be a moment where we come together and say, we want better. I say this all the time. I support the police. I support law enforcement when they're not wrong. I don't think that's hard to come around to.
And I think that the, you know, the vast majority of people in this country want to see a police force that is really taking crime in their communities seriously, is focusing on the things that is focusing on addressing and solving violent crime in particular, and not spending all of their time, you know, pulling over drivers for something hanging from the rearview mirror, broken taillight. Because that's the way that, you know, so much of policing resources are spent these days.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, the profiling that goes on for nonsensical stops, it should be one of those civil liberty things that both sides understands and agrees on. And I guess I don't want to diminish the fact that that overwhelmingly, you know, blacks are stopped more often than whites, and that these things happen. I don't want to diminish that. I don't want to make it sound like I'm diminishing it, but I want to make sure that people understand it's just not black people who end up getting killed on the side of the road at the hands of police. Now, look, sometimes, you know, things happen, and I'm not saying every time is a Tyre Nichols moment, but, you know, understand this happens across the board. And again, I want to try and pull people into the understand that we want police that are going to protect and serve. I still remember that being the slogan.
And I think that, you know, what is one of the hardest things about really trying to sort of find a way to identify solutions is that, you know, what happens every time there is, you know, someone killed and you know, the national outrage that follows is that more trust is eroded between police and the communities they serve across the board. And so, yes, while black communities already have, a harder time trusting police and they have, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that. That these types of horrific, violent instances of violence really just sets us back in terms of, you know, bridging the gap between police and community.
No, you're right. And again, we kept hearing if we just had policemen who looked more like their communities, well, the Tyre Nichols situation is, you know, the police look just like the guy they murdered. I mean, you know, what do you do there? For me, though, it comes back down to training. And I've made this point numerous times that, you know, when I was younger, it was always put your hands on the hood of the car when they were arresting you. They spread your legs, they pat you down, they handcuff you, and that's how you got arrested. Now it's slam you to the ground. You know, people laying on your legs, laying on your back, knees in your back, holding your arms down while yelling, you know, 1,000 different commands, because that's how they're trained. There's something for me that goes, the training is wrong.
Yeah, and there are definitely, you know, opportunities for improvements in training to get at just what you're talking about around, you know, how you approach someone in a given situation with an eye towards de-escalation, how we can actually integrate a duty to intervene, meaning that like other officers who are around have a duty if they see something going wrong to actually step in and try and mitigate the situation. But I also have to, you know, I have to make the point that training alone is not enough, right? We also, not only do we need training, we need policy change, and we need culture change, right? We need culture change that, we need policy change that sort of de-emphasizes a police involvement in all of these low-level traffic stops, and we need culture change that you know, connects people with the community, connects police officers with the community.
No, look, I know, you know, a couple of policemen, and you know, they, I truly believe that most cops don't want to do these horrible things. I truly believe that. I don't believe that any of these five cops showed up on that day, or the, all of the ones that got fired, and go, "Hey, we're going to go kill somebody today." I don't believe that. That at least I don't want to believe that. But in, with the policemen that I talk to, they're cognizant of the reality that, you know, the old phrase, "You know what," rolls downhill, and we've done all kinds of, you know, defunding mental health treatment. We've done all kinds of things to where we're, as a society, not dealing with our problems, and it all ends up on the back of the policemen on the street, and they've got to make snap decisions based on, you know, how are they going to go home at night, and I completely understand that. So there's got to be a way where we roll some of this back, especially now where guns are more prevalent than they've ever been. I got to tell you, if I'm a cop pulling somebody over, I'm going to be worried, too. I'm going to be concerned for my safety as well. It's not forgiving any of the behavior. It's not forgiving any of the things that we saw in those videos. But I got to tell you, I'm a little, I get the fact that they're worried for their own safety as well. And I think that has to be part of this conversation as well.
Absolutely. And I think one of the key ways to get at that is that, you know, police are just responding to too much. We are asking too much of them. We're asking them to be, you know, mental health counselors and case managers. And we're asking them to, you know, identify everything wrong with someone's vehicle. When the reality is that they just, they're, is not a need for police to interact with people as often as they do.
You're absolutely right. And I go back again to, you know, when I was younger, we didn't have as many policemen on the streets. You know, you dealt with, you lived your life, and you weren't always looking over your shoulder. What we did, especially in poor communities, white and black, is we loaded those communities up with policemen. Now, you know, the sad reality, when I was a kid, our house got robbed probably 20 times. And we called the police. They never showed up. But, you know, now we have, like, I think an oversaturation where people are starting to go, well, how are you justifying having all these police and crime statistics not coming down? I think you're right. We've done too much policing. At least that's the thought that I've got. Am I on the right page?
I think that that's spot on. There's you know, a need to really think about when someone believes that they need assistance in our society for one reason or another, what is the right response, right? If someone is experiencing, you know, a mental health disability, we should be sending someone with mental health training. If someone has a broken taillight, they don't necessarily need to be pulled over by a police, an armed police officer, right? Because we know, for such a small thing, there's such a high risk of things escalating.
Yeah, but let me ask you this, because I've had this argument thrown at me before, and I've actually had policemen go, "Okay, let's walk through this exercise. We're not going to put an armed policeman pulling someone over for a minor traffic violation. So let's say you pull somebody over for that minor traffic violation, but they have committed something of a crime, and their mind isn't going, hey, this is just a broken taillight. This is me going back to jail." And they shoot that unarmed person. You know, how do you respond to their families? I don't know that I'm comfortable having unarmed people pulling people over. I just wish we wouldn't. I wish we had policemen that would de-escalate situations, as opposed to what we saw in the Tyre Nichols videos of people who just came out and the situation was escalated from the get-go. I'm curious thought.
I mean, I think that, you know, there's always going to be, you know, situations that happen that are sort of outliers. I think that what we would end up seeing if you just had fewer armed police officers engage in this type of traffic enforcement is that the people will know that there's, you know, they're not being pulled over by police, that there's not a significant risk that they're going to be arrested because they're being pulled over by someone who's not a cop. And so
Having meter maids
from the start would make a different reaction.
Okay, so like having meter maids doing traffic enforcement,
right?
Because I don't know that a lot of meter maids get shot for writing parking tickets. Maybe they do. I don't have the statistics on that. So last line of questioning I've got for you. Is there any legislation that's moving forward? I know that, you know, there was some talk about the George Floyd Act. I know there was some talk about, you know, something. Now with a Republican House, I don't see any possibility of passing anything. Or do they have an idea?
I mean, I think that there are going to be efforts to revive negotiations around legislation. I share your skepticism that waiting for Congress is not going to produce the results that we need. I think that there, you know, the calls are to the Biden administration to do things that are within his power in terms of how funding is flowing from the Department of Transportation for highway safety, and the way, all of the ways that that incentivizes more like pretextual policing, and kind of changing the practices around their funding and grant making to limit that from happening, or to build on the executive order that the Biden administration issued last year to strengthen some of the use of force standards and things like that. And then there's a lot that can be done at the state and local level. You know, states can pass their own legislation. We're seeing that happening around not enforcing low-level traffic stops, and can build new tools like and determine, you know, the utility of and the success rates for things like we're just talking about, civilian traffic enforcement. I mean, these are all things that both can be incentivized by the federal government and can also be acted upon by states and localities.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I still come back to the training as a huge part of this, because that de-escalation, you know, again, I think about interactions that I've had with police that have gone good and that have gone bad. And, you know, it always comes back to the person who's in the uniform, who has the power. You know, are they, you know, trying to calm you down and you know, things are going to be all right. You'll get through this. You know, you know what you did, or are they trying to, you know, come up and be angry and escalate situations? I think that has a lot to do with a lot of things that we deal with. But I hope we get something done. The further down the road this goes, I'd love to have you come back and share some more thoughts, because I don't think anyone wants to see the kind of videos and the kind of things that we've seen. I just don't. But Rachel, I appreciate the time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Rachel Eisenberg, Senior Director of Criminal Justice Reform there at the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org is their website. I'll take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1883, marking the deadliest day in Illinois mining history at the time. 74 boys and men lost their lives digging for coal in the diamond mine disaster in Braidwood, Illinois. The Wilmington Coal and Manufacturing Company owned the mine. It was located in a marshy, low-lying area. At midday, the east side of the mine collapsed from the weight of the melting snow. The combination of melting snow and heavy rains flooded the mine. Those trapped below could not open the ventilation doors against the heavy weight of the water. Two of those who lost their lives that day were just 13 years old. One miner, John Huber, recounted his experience. I rushed as fast as the nature of the passage would allow to where I thought my sons were at work, but found that they had gone. I then yelled at the top of my voice to the men near me and made as fast as I could for the air shaft, where I knew there was a ladder and I could get out. By this time, the water was up to my armpits, and I had a hard time to get up the shaft. When he finally escaped the mine, he learned his sons had not made it out. After the disaster, it took 7 steam pumps 38 days to remove enough water to attempt to rescue the bodies. Falling rocks and accumulation of gas made recovery work very dangerous. 46 of the dead were never recovered. In 1898, the United Mine Workers of America placed a memorial at the site. The Diamond Mine disaster was one tragic entry of many that plagued the mining industry. During the first two decades of the 20th century, mining claimed nearly 50,000 lives in the United States. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2. Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick at therickssmithshow.com. Got an email from someone unknown. Just simply said, you hate policemen. And I go, no, I don't. This is not what this is about. It was that simple. You hate policemen. I don't. I respect them. You know, I have a family member who was a cop for years and years. I've had friends who have become policemen, and look, I've seen what it's done to people, the culture that has been that has involved. And I think about a friend I went to high school with, was probably the biggest pansy I've ever known. Was a guy who, you know, I used to beat him. We played basketball, and he was like 6'7". He was an incredible basketball player, but was weak. Was not somebody who would. If you pushed him, he wouldn't push you back. So we would play basketball, and I would just beat him, you know, constantly, because you know he wouldn't drive to the lane, he wouldn't body up with anybody, and you know he lost a lot of opportunities to go on to play college ball because he was such, you know, he was such a wimp. Just what he was, he would not stand up for himself. And I know I'm going to get a lot of hate email on that too, but you know, do what you got to do. But he went and became a university policeman, a college cop, not even, you know, a real city cop, but a university policeman in a city. And within 2 years, he was hyper aggressive, you know, and charged, you know, multiple times with police brutality. And, you know, I'm going, how is it that culture was able to get this guy who, you know, and I'll never forget the day I walked up to him and went, hey, how you doing? I punched him in the arm and he punched me back and I hugged him. And I'm going, finally, I didn't realize what was going on. Long story very short, he ended up getting hurt on the job because of an escalated situation. And, you know, I go back to that, you know, maybe had he been that guy who was just a nice guy, you know, maybe situations wouldn't have gotten out of hand, but it was the people that he was surrounded with. So maybe choosing the kind of people that we choose, you know, sometimes plays into that. I want people who are going to de-escalate situations. I want people who are going to, you know, be decent. You know, I think about all of the times that I've had interactions with police over the years. And the people who did it well and the people who didn't. You know, there are people who, you know, look, you know what you did. We're going to write you a ticket. You know, here's how you go about it. You know, you have a good day. You know, is what it was. You know what you did. And then the people who come up and they're like, somehow you offended them personally. Like somehow, you know, like they're you're a child and they're scolding you and they're escalating tension. And escalating a situation that they don't have to. And again, my interactions, you know, have been mild. But I can see where, you know, if you're you know, poor, maybe a little mouthy, things can get really out of hand. Now, here's the other part of this. I'm hoping at some point we can find ground where we're no longer mistreating each other. Because I look at some of the behavior by some people towards policemen, and I find that absolutely deplorable as well. I'm sorry, these are people who are just doing a job. And you respect those people until they give you a reason not to. Now, again, I do believe police need to command respect by earning it. But also, you know, just their mere presence shouldn't elicit the kind of disrespect. Because that just, again, that just, people are human.
The Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council present the story of Cynthia and Ed. My mother was always very active and independent, and she was familiar with her neighborhood. But one day, out of the blue, she stopped at the stop sign for much longer than usual. And she didn't know whether she should go forward or turn or just stay at the stop sign. She wasn't even really sure where she was at. She was very concerned. It was very unsettling for her.
It's important for you to talk to someone about it, to bring the family in on it. I felt so much better after my son told me, Mom, I don't want you to worry or be afraid. I'll be there for you and we'll figure it out.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. Visit alz.org/ourstories to learn more. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
WFHR Wisconsin Rapids, 1320 AM and W248DE, broadcasting at 97.5 FM.